If you live to be 80 or 90 years old, you might see a human launched in a rocket headed to Mars. In the meantime, NASA's planning a series of interim steps aimed at someday getting astronauts further than low Earth orbit. Because of how complex those plans are, the NASA Inspector General took a detailed look. Kevin Fagadis is Project Manager for Space Operations in the NASA IG office. He spoke with Federal News Radio's Tom Temin about their findings.
NASA has issued a framework for the journey to Mars. They issued it in 2015. So that combined with their three systems, their three major systems that they have, the Space Launch System, the Orion capsule, and also the Ground Systems Development and Operations, which is all the ground setup. Those three had all passed the critical design review back in 2015, the summer to fall 2015. So they were already on their way to fabricating and testing and integrating. So what we thought is there's been individual audits or reviews done on each one of these systems over time, but no one's ever really looked at them all together and then take the context of the journey to Mars and take a look at how they're proceeding. So we brought it all together at a much bigger picture than the smaller individual pieces.
And what did you find as your overall assessment of whether they'll be able to carry this out in the time and budget they've given themselves?
That's a good question. And, it's like all budgeteers would say is, there's a lot of ifs and there's a lot of it depends, as we go along this progress. But what we found is that NASA has a very good framework that they've laid out. They look like, based upon current budget projections, is they have sufficient monies to make it to execute exploration mission number one, which is scheduled right now for November 2018, but may slip.
That's unmanned, correct?
That's exactly, Tom. That's the unmanned crewed mission. But I think you know this, but NASA is currently examining, based upon current guidance, to see if they can put astronauts on that first mission. That report is not out yet, expected to maybe be released, the decision around the May time period. That, of course, would have a big effect on the development. So, given basic current projections for the budget, they look like they're set for EM1. What we did find, though, for EM2 is a little bit more challenging for a couple reasons. One is there isn't really a formal commitment on the cost and the schedule with all three programs leading up to EM2, which is currently scheduled for 2021. And the way the current budget projections are, kind of uncertain, taking a look at their budget versus the cost estimates, that there's going to be sufficient for EM2.
And to put a crew on either one of these, that does make the stakes higher and therefore the expenses and the design requirements tougher, correct?
That's a very good point, Tom. So exactly, that's why NASA is doing an in-depth examination of what that would mean to put crew on the first mission. Because remember, this was originally designed, the whole program was designed not to put crew on the first mission and do that as a first flight test, essentially, of the whole system. So to move the crew up on it, the Orion capsule, which is on the top that the astronauts go in, needs to be human rated. The first mission wasn't going to have an environmental control system in it, so that one has to be established. Based upon the first flight of the Orion, where they tested it, they decided to change the type of the heat shield on the capsule. So what's going to have to happen is that's a new heat shield that's on there. Plus, the second stage, which is an interim cryogenic propulsion system, that's essentially the second part of the space launch system, that one also will need to get human rated because it wasn't planned for astronauts on.
And so these sound conceptually clear, but often I would imagine when you get into the detailed engineering, there could be strings of problems that come up that may be solvable, but could really stretch out the schedule and cost.
That's a very good point. And that was one of our concerns that we had in our findings in the report, is that NASA, as far as the three programs are concerned, have a very small amount of either schedule reserves or monetary reserves, meaning there's not much time in the schedule in case something goes wrong or there's a technical problem that they want to further flesh out. What that would mean, of course, is launch dates become delayed. As far as the money's concerned is NASA, we think, did a pretty good job estimating what they needed for the flights all the way up to exploration mission number one, the one in November 2018. But if that schedule slips, that obviously costs more money. And they really do not have monetary reserves that will buy down those risks or those technical problems. Now, what they can do is they can tap into EM2 money. because they do have money that are building for EM2, and they'd have to pull that forward.
We're speaking with Kevin Fagadies. He's project manager for space operations in the NASA Inspector General's office. And that EM2 for 2021, that sounds like further out. And if they're going to send someone actually to Mars in the 2030s, the schedule gets a little vaguer as you get forward in the future. EM2 would have a crew if it goes, and how far would it go with that crew?
Well, that EM2 crew, it stays within what's called cislunar orbit. So what it would do is it would do a test ride around the Earth at low Earth orbit to make sure all the systems are working. They would probably do the same in EM1. And then based upon whether the crew flies on EM1 or EM2, you know, then they do an orbit around the moon. But NASA would want to make sure that, of course, all the systems test out in low Earth orbit before they then do a loop around the moon and do a mission. The EM1 non-crewed mission would probably be a longer mission. It'd be about 25 days, and they would follow a similar path as a test.
And to go from lunar orbit to check out all of this, what is required to make the leap from that distance to the really big one, which is a couple of years away out in space?
Good question again, Tom. That's a big leap from cislunar to go into what is called deep space, which would be the journey to Mars. You know, even just a flyby, so for instance, NASA's looking at a first mission to go in vicinity of Mars, maybe the moon Phobos, which is in the vicinity of Mars. At a minimum, even just a flyby to go by Mars, look at it, and come back, that's a year-long mission. So that's the challenge of the deep space, right, is you're gone for 1 year at a minimum, and much longer if you're going to land on the Mars surface later on to do that. So your system's got to be working. Things got to go very well for you. And then, of course, there's, which we didn't address in our report, but in previous reports it was addressed, which is the effects of the environment, obviously, of deep space on the astronauts. The major concern is, you know, how's that going to affect the astronauts during that year-long mission? Things like radiation, which is very difficult to protect the astronaut from receiving high doses of radiation.
Yeah, so the hardware, they can pretty well predict how that would stand up. It's the so-called meatware inside that is the issue for the long distance far in the future.
Exactly, Tom. And that's why NASA has rightly used the International Space Station as a proving ground, as essentially what they call phase zero, which is to test a lot of these things out and to monitor the effects on the astronauts in low Earth orbit. Now, they're much more protected in low Earth orbit than it would be in deep space, but it's a great proving ground for NASA to be able to test a lot of these concepts and environmental systems up there in low Earth orbit.
So there's a lot of challenges yet. They seem to be in good shape for the near term, pretty good shape for the medium term, and then long term still questions. What were your main recommendations in this report?
Our main recommendations that we had was the first, there were a total of six that we had, Tom. The first one is, like we talked about, as EM1 is moving along, but EM2 is a little bit more unclear when it comes to the money required in the schedule. So what we recommended is NASA complete what's called an integrated master schedule for the three systems, the Space Launch System, Orion, and the ground systems for the EM2 mission, and kind of lay that out to make sure that there's enough schedule and money available to be able to do that mission as they planned, right? The second one was also related to EM2, which is they did a very good job. Like I said, they seem to be on the money pretty good for EM1 as long as it doesn't slip. But as far as what they think they require to do EM1, they did a good job and they followed a very rigorous process. EM2 not as so rigorous, so we asked for them to do a little bit more cost and schedule estimates, kind of in tune with the first recommendation. The third one's a little bit more long-term. The third one was early on, they've established objectives for the early phases of the journey to Mars, but the later ones are not kind of laid out there, and most of the systems don't have what we call need-by dates, when you need to have the system ready to go. And so what we think is if you make that a little bit more firm, that'll help the schedule and cost
sure.
as you go forward. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The fourth one was when they did their feasibility studies for the systems, we did it in conjunction. We used some of the work that the Joint Propulsion Lab did. The National Research Council did some. And Aerospace Corporation, which supports a lot of the NASA and the Air Force projects. NASA has really not put a cost on a lot of these individual pieces that need to fly. You know, the deep space systems, the propulsion systems, they now have a deep space gateway that they want to put up in cislunar orbit. We just didn't see cost being used as a factor when they did this. And of course, as you know, in developments, there's always trade-offs, right, between what you want and what the cost is going to be, right?
Could it be also that they're maybe worried about putting out the real cost of this because then Congress would get involved?
That's true. I think that's part of the reason, is to take it one step at a time, because in previous times when the full cost is, you know, has been brought out, it gets kind of scary, you know, when you look at it. So that's certainly one reason. But what we were talking about on this one, though, we're not talking about, you know, what it costs by 2033 or 2046 or the second, you know, 1 year stay on Mars. What we're talking about is the individual systems and the basic costs.
Sure.
As you're building, if that makes sense.
And you had two more recommendations, and let's get to those quickly.
Right. Yeah, very quickly. The last two really have to do with, you know, case studies have shown that, and the National Research Council also confirmed this, is, you know, we really need International Space Agency participation. And NASA's already done it with the International Space Station, right? I mean, that's been up there since 1998 and fully manned since 2000, so 17 years worth of, you know, international cooperation. Well, although that's not the exact model, some of those kind of tenets can be applied over to maybe the journey to Mars, right? With some caveats, see, because a lot of the other space agencies, the foreign space agencies, they want to go to the moon first, and that isn't necessarily in our program. So getting them involved early, like they did in the space station, will help defray costs. The second one is commercial capabilities. You're familiar with SpaceX and Orbital.
Sure,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Support of the space station. Those two entities, they ended up at a very reasonable development cost, provided NASA capability to get to the space station. Who knows? With the modules that are out there, the future rockets that maybe Blue Origin or SpaceX or Boeing or all these companies are developing maybe for launch capabilities, that may be a possibility to integrate in some of NASA's efforts. So we just asked NASA to consider how they can and develop a strategy for including them in, you know, these deep space missions, in particular the journey to Mars.
Sounds like the agency that kind of invented project management as it's understood in this and the late last century just needs to tighten its tone up a little bit.
Well, like you mentioned before, it's kind of coming out and laying out a cost is when there's so many uncertainties for the future. You know, one of the reasons, a legitimate reason, you know, as we move along, is there is a belief, and a right belief, that technology will help solve some of these problems and also make things cheaper. NASA's using that to try and drive down costs. So, for instance, our third finding or our third section in the report discussed how NASA has some great strategies to try and drive down future costs. You know, so, for instance, let me just give you one example. You know, right now, you know, the basic model is a cryogenic, you know, type of propulsion system that takes you all the way to Mars. Well, NASA's exploring solar energy, solar electric propulsion is one option, nuclear thermal is another option, or even using methane, which some of the commercial companies are already starting to experiment with, using methane as a propulsion system around the vicinity of Mars and then mine it at Mars while you're there. Do it on site. It's kind of mine some of your fuel. That would drive down a lot of your costs because you wouldn't have to carry all that fuel with you.
Kevin Fagadis is project manager for space operations for the NASA Inspector General. You can find a link to his report and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.